my...
Well, yeah, anyway. After I would visit these places, I noticed a pattern that within a couple of weeks or a month, there would be a minor attack in the area.
Oh.
And so I eventually became paranoid. Mm-hmm. But this, what was happening north of the Mekong River was a large area of northern Laos that was controlled by the Chinese, not by the North Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
North Vietnamese were interested in Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in, they were engaged in a very active war, obviously. But the northern Laos, where the Chinese were, they weren't so much interested in the war because they were not even necessarily interested in the North Vietnamese so much. They were in competition with the Russians, and the North Vietnamese were the clients of the Russians.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So their goals were different. Their goal was to establish a presence, and also they were interested in building a road infrastructure and so forth to facilitate communication with China.
Uh-huh.
And also they had hopes of an infiltration route into Thailand, which passed to the west of us.
Yeah.
And there was a CIA agent in that village. A CIA agent meaning just somebody who coordinated the logistics for militia troops in the area. I mean,
okay.
He wasn't, you know, he didn't have a, didn't wear dark glasses and a rain trench coat. He,
and I probably wore a short sleeve shirt and...
He was on the radio saying, we need so much rice or we need so much ammunition or we need so many shirts and stuff like that.
Because I was wondering what you meant by Chinese engineers. This clarifies that.
Yeah, so they were interested in this infiltration route into Thailand because the North Vietnamese were competing for the East Coast, but the Chinese didn't. The Chinese wouldn't even have wanted the North Vietnamese probably to take all of Laos. They wanted. China has a. I mean, the King of Thailand's half part Chinese anyway, and. So, in fact, when the Chinese engineers finished a river, and finished a road to a place called Pak Bang, which was where the Bang River, the mouth of the Bang River, Pak Bang means the mouth of the Bang, there was a town there on the north side of the Mekong, and upstream a little bit from where I was. When that road was finished, that meant they could bring in heavy military equipment. And when they finished that road, then we were informed that we had to leave, and we did. And the subsequent years, while I was teaching English, they in fact brought over artillery and mortar and things like that.
But you had pretty close to 2 years in agriculture.
Yeah. I was there over a year in Hong Sa, and then I worked elsewhere a little bit in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So my feeling was a sense of failing, you know, a sense we were losing the war, a sense that our projects, while well-intended, weren't...
For whatever reason.
...weren't succeeding. I mean, the fact that this project was designed to feed the royal capital, but was, in fact, feeding troops that were gradually losing positions. I mean, I heard a position being overrun.
Yeah. You were listening to a radio.
Single sideband
while
radio.
While it was going on.
Yeah. And then also that American who was, remember there was an American in Laos, it was in Time magazine, there was a big to-do about it because an American soldier got killed and somehow it got in the newspaper. And this was fairly late, I mean this was 69 probably. Americans weren't supposed to get killed in Laos because there was no war.
To be there.
There was no war there.
Yeah.
I didn't hear him myself, but somebody who was with me and who was living in the IVS house and had access to the radio heard this guy say he was leaving leaving where he was, leaving the radio. Abandoning the place because it was being overrun.
And he didn't make it.
He didn't make it. And so there was this sense of things falling apart. As Chinua Achebe, well, like he's quoting Yeats, but When I had to leave the village, leave this old man's house at one point because they were worried about security.
Yes.
And so I went up in the village, there a river separated two parts of the village, and one part was where most people lived. The other part was sort of a high bluff, and there was an airport up there, and a police station, an army camp, the IVS house, and the mayor's office. And I went up to a building near the mayor's office with the Thai engineer, and the bed sagged, so to support the mattress underneath it, I moved the boxes of dynamite under the bed, figured, well, it's probably better to go in style than linger.
Have such a big bang that it'll probably take the guys out who are shooting up right along with you.
It wasn't a Lao home. It was a hut. It was built with bamboo and so forth, rattan walls, bamboo walls and so forth. But it was built for this Thai engineer. So there was an underplace where things were stored, tools and so forth were stored too. That was closed. I don't know whether it was.
So it wasn't like the typical house where someone
right,
could walk
but I'm
underneath.
Sure somebody could have gotten under, but.
Not
but
as
the idea
as
was that if anyone gets under, it doesn't matter whether you're sleeping on a
Sealy Posturepedic or on dynamite.
Right. the niece of the old man brought me food, and that was my wife. She and her mother, her mother had divorced the father. Had followed the father from the village to the capital, Vientiane, where he was an army officer. And after a number of years of marriage, she divorced him, went back to the village. And they were there as sort of poor relatives. And so they would help the Lao, share kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way of educating and disciplining kids without, hitting them or without a single parent bearing the whole burden of discipline. Kids, just by being with other people, learn the things that a nuclear family might teach it by yelling at them or spanking them or something like that. It's a different way of disciplining and educating children that creates a very very pleasant personality, a very social, agreeable, tolerant. So they, in exchange for rice, they would help out his household and so forth. But anyway,
your wife's
uncle.
Part of the family.
Yeah. So this rich old man, although he lived in a house that was very similar to everyone else's, maybe a little bit bigger. But he had a mill. He had a rice mill, and he had the contract. And he had, before World War II, that area had actually been part of Thailand. And he had a Thai aristocratic title. He'd been given a title by the Thai king. And he had a pension and things like that. So even though when you go to his house, he would look pretty much, maybe not even as big as the district chief's house, he was a wealthy man, but you don't display it. It's because they're not ostentatious. You don't know that until you know him better. But so he would give my wife's family
rice. And some of the
rice.
Wealth sounds honorific, wealth.
Yeah.
Rather than
right.
material.
Although to own a rice mill and a sawmill.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the titles that he got, the Thai titles and
the
respect and et cetera.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they kept feeding me. I paid them to continue to bring me food, and I ate pretty much what my wife's family ate, which meant often it was just mushroom soup with, we didn't get so many shrimp and snails and things like the rich man, her uncle had.
Okay.
But because it was coming directly from her mother's house, it was simple fare. But I got very sick with sprue, which is a deficiency of folic acid.
Oh.
And it as like a form of indigestion. So I got weak, and
sounds like something that could be taken care of rather quickly, though.
Yeah, right. But I got all sorts of parasites, and because a lot of people are thin or sick, you don't feel different. It's like being in danger. When everyone's in danger, you don't feel so bad because you don't feel different. It's when you feel different than others that you sort of, you compare yourself with others. And, when we had to leave, they said that the village would not be safe for my wife's mother and her, because they had been working for me and because it looked like the war was going to come to the town. Because they needed support too, and because they knew the capital, they followed me to the capital. And I tried to help them set up there. I went to live with another Lao family in the capital. I went to work at the National Rice Research Institute there, and which was another story in itself. And I lived with a family near there. And I tried to help my wife and her mother set up sewing clothes for the army and so on. But eventually, that didn't look like it would work out. And I said, well, if I do nothing else, if nothing else works out, I'm just going to save a person. You know, sort of like I ended up in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And I decided to commit myself to my wife, to the Sanction and her family. And but when I went to the National Rice Research Institute, what I discovered, the big issue there was that the Minister of Agriculture was stockpiling gasoline. He was saying he needed it for the tractors there and so forth. And he had this huge stockpile of gasoline and oil that he was selling.
Yeah.
And making money. And the director there was somebody who had been trained in Australia, a Laotian, who was very conscientious. He'd been in Australia too long. And he came back, and I was stationed there with him. He said, oh, I've got to tell you about this terrible corruption that's going on. Well, we were both there about a year, and eventually he caught on that he was supposed to be quiet. And I was transferred out. And the Americans had suspected all along that something was going along, but they, I don't know whether they reduced the quantity of gasoline. I mean, obviously they couldn't take away what he, Minister of Agriculture was too, he wasn't appointed because he was a great farmer. He was appointed because he had connections and...
He's probably a Lao relative, could have been a royal relative.
Yeah. Yes, he was. Matter of fact, he was royalty.
Okay.
He was an aristocrat. He had a title.
Yeah.
And it was a process of education for the Americans. I mean, they make an army general there. His official pay was $70 a month. So, what army general is going to? I mean, no IVSer lived on $70 a month. I mean.
Yeah, and most IBSers are not that far out of college. And you've got a general who's worked all this way all the way up and is making less.
Yeah.
Of course he's going to have ghost troops.
Yeah. I was there about a year. I went south briefly to an incredible place. There was a Swiss missionary nurse there. I went to a village, and there were some unfinished projects that IVS had sort of pulled out. The area had been overrun once, and they had left, the communists had left, and the project had sort of stopped, and we sort of went back to see if they could be revived, but the situation wasn't promising. But I did get a chance to go up river. There was a river there. And there was a bridge on that river, actually downstream, that looked like... It was so incredibly fortified. It was an essential bridge to the north-south route.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all sorts of fortifications. It was overflown by these little propeller-driven planes. And, but farther upriver was a village where a Swiss missionary nurse had spent her life.
Huge
woman. She had a hospice. She had a huge medicine cabinet that acted as a dispensary. She was a midwife. She cooked huge pots of food and grain to people. Some people in the area were hungry because they were refugees, or there were floods one year. She would make demands on the missionaries in the cities that they said drove them crazy, because they couldn't refuse her, and often they would involve a tremendous amount of effort to get her what she wanted. But she was sort of like a queen in this mm-hmm. village. And there were two sort of twin villages, and one had gone with the missionaries,
uh-huh.
and one had stayed Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
But when the area was overrun, she stayed. There was another missionary couple in the village that fled. She said, I delivered most of them. I'm not going to run away. And she stayed, and the Royal Army retook the village, and there were air raids and everything. She just, calm as could be, just stayed. Just an incredible woman, just somebody that just so far above it all, but so much into it all, just everything, every need that people could have from birth to death. I mean, when we went there, she had this huge European bed in one room that practically filled the room. Right in the middle of the bed was an infant. And then there was another wing of the building where people were dying. People didn't have a place to die, could come and die. And then there were this madhouse in another shack where she was weighing out grain, rice grain for people. Another place there was cook food and people all gathered around and eating. And,
uh-huh.
And then we went to a service there, and she sat up front. She was a missionary, but the Lao were conducting the service, and she was sleeping. It was wonderful.
She was sleeping.
That's probably the only time she had a rest in the whole day. Oh, God. But I was there briefly. And that just sort of reinforced my sense that things were falling apart. And what's important, I think, in the end, are people and relationships. And I'm sorry I only had, in Nigeria it ended up one person, one little girl.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed better than nothing.
Yeah, I was wondering, one question that I had when I read over your completed form, I forget how my question here is, what was your success in your hoped for mitigating role? Because that seemed to be what you had decided after, I didn't know it when I read this, but after, I guess, your Peace Corps experience, that you wanted to have this mitigating role, to take the moral high ground.
Yeah.
And you've sort of answered in a negative, but not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, after my wife's village fell completely, after uh-huh. the...
What happened to the
coalition world? Government was formed, and I helped translate the agreement. The agreement was in French and in Lao, and I helped translate the Lao agreement. But my wife's younger brother
uh-huh.
Was a cadet in the National Military Academy, which was a high school type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And he had worked very hard to get into that, and his father was a captain. Was a combat captain for 20 years.
So your wife's father?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Who was divorced from her mother.
Right.
He went
back
up.
Together.
Yeah, now back together. He went up to the village and to see what was going on.
The brother?
The brother.
Okay.
Just for a visit to see relatives and so on. And he had a chance to talk with the army officers of the garrison that had been overrun. And they were about to be taken off to a re-education camp, which for officers generally meant a death camp. They would die of disease or malnutrition. They would work on minimum diet and so forth, cut wood or do something until... And my, in fact, my brother-in-law ended up in one too, but he survived long enough to run away. And he survived. He was in camp for about 4 years. His father managed to slip out of town because his father, in addition to being an army captain...
This is the wealthy old man.
No, that was my wife's father.
That's right, yes. I'm sorry, my wife's father.
In addition to being a soldier, was also a farmer and was had a little shop. So he was able to sort of fade into the countryside. But he went up there and he talked to the army officers and they said to him, you know, your brother-in-law did a great job up here.
You were already married by then?
Yeah, okay. Right. Because after about my second year of teaching, I got married because I was entitled to a house in the city. And I hadn't had raises in a number of years, so...
I got the chronology thing. I thought you were still in your first 2 years.
We're moving ahead.
You're moving ahead, and this the village follows while you're in education.
I did the Rice Institute, which was sort of the end of the two years, and then a brief period in the South, where we thought we could start things up again, and we couldn't. We had to leave.
Okay.
And came back to the capital. The only thing open then was teaching.
Which was okay.
Range. University of Hawaii, brand new school, Laotian curriculum, sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. And they gave me a big house and in the city, and I had a number of raises.
So you could afford to get married.
I could afford to get married and did so. And then I taught for a couple of years, and my wife sort of audited. I didn't ask them, but they invited her to audit some homemaking classes and things like that, not the academic ones, because she couldn't have gotten anything out of them at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And
even though she's very smart.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people in the world that are smart, and it's just, to me, it's just, we're losing it. You know, when you can't bring people's talents out, that's just talent you're losing.
Absolutely.
It's not... I mean, maybe it's competition, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just enrichment. Maybe we're all better when we're each talents. Each of our talents are brought out.
Yeah.
But
anyway, so it was in your second year of teaching that
your
brother-in-law, then brother-in-law, went up to the village and talked to these officers who were about to be taken.
Well, no, it was more than the second year of teaching. I think it was the second year of teaching... maybe I got married, or the first year of teaching. I got married, and then, maybe a year after that, or a little bit more.
Okay.
I forget when the, might have been 72 when the coalition government was formed.
Yeah.
But they had said that, and I thought that was, I mean, considering everything that everyone had been through and was about to go through, I felt a sense of peace there. At least there wasn't bitterness. These people weren't even worried about their own situation. They were considerate enough to say something nice to my brother-in-law, rather than just saying, "Get out of here, kid. We got our problems," or something. Which the Lao wouldn't do anyway.
Yeah. And these were Royal Laotian Army officers.
But they weren't aristocracy or anything. They were probably kids who had, maybe their parents were school teachers or something like that. They'd worked their way up in the education system. They had a few connections and they got an officer training. But basically they were bright kids who had been well enough connected to take advantage of opportunities. And generally conscientious and pleasant. See, a Laotian farmer might have, in terms of education, might know some Sanskrit, certainly know some Pali. from being in the temple and so on,
mm-hmm.
have some knowledge of Hindu and Buddhist scripture. And it gives you, it gives people a sense of perspective. Even though they're mostly animists in their practice, it still
mm-hmm. yeah.
gives you a feeling, a character, and a personality, a typical personality that pervades the culture that is very distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, tell me a bit about this University of Hawaii program.
It was a great program, and the school was built, the curriculum was built. I helped with the English curriculum. As a matter of fact, I mm-hmm. helped write a textbook.
Oh,
it was
okay.
never published, but we did finish. We did drawings and text and so forth, dialogues and. And I was first. I was chairman of the English teacher and English department until some. The Oceans had graduated from the University of Hawaii, and they came back and they took over, and I played in a supporting role.
Uh huh.
And I really enjoyed it. Students had varied backgrounds. Some of them had, one boy who was very good had been a soldier for many years, and he was still a young boy, high school age. Uh-huh. He'd been taken out of sixth grade. Someone had pointed a gun at his head and said, "You're going to fight," and he couldn't even pick up the gun. It was so big, and he'd lost his father and several brothers.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got into the fighting, he loved it. He said one time he was going through the forest, and they sat down to rest, and they realized someone else was nearby, and they looked around, not the other side of the tree, but just the other side of where they were, and there were some communists there, and they shot them. They surprised the communists.
Uh-huh.
And they said that they used to, he said they used to get in fortified positions, and when he wasn't over by where the North Vietnamese were, he was more where the Chinese were. They would send troops that were unarmed first.
The Chinese?
The communists. Mm. It was more in the Chinese area, with sticks instead of guns. And they would be killed. And then behind him, we come the guys with guns. And mm-hmm. that's like Korea. I don't think that was typical of the North Vietnamese. That's more Chinese now.
Why would they do that?
To use up ammunition. To use up the ammunition of the people in the...
Whew.
But, so he had a lot of... But he was... He wasn't... he had, the war had made him into a... It made him into a person who was alive and who was determined to get the most out of life.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't destroyed him. So he could share his experiences, he could throw himself into his studies, he got an exchange scholarship in the United States. He just, he was on fire. And,
But he was a graduate of the Hawaii program?
No, he was just a high school student.
Oh, he was a high school student.
Yeah, he was
within
one of my
this
students.
High school
yeah.
program. Okay, all right.
Yeah. That just shows you, as the war wound down,
uh-huh.
how young the combatants became. I mean, 12,
yes,
13
okay.
years
yes,
old.
Yes, that's clear. I was
yeah.
just unsure about
yeah.
his role because of the
right.
the thing to the States.
Right.
Okay.
But the University of Hawaii, and that worked out well. The school's still there. The trees that were planted are now big trees.
That isn't the Dundalk, is it?
No.
Okay.
Dundalk was teacher training college, and IVS played a big role there. That's Fang Um.
Ah, okay, yeah. Because many people were through that.
Yeah.
And I thought that's what you were talking
no,
about. No,
Fang Um was much later, towards the end of the war, but it was completed before the war, before people left. And so I was teaching there when we got 10 minutes notice to leave. And we had made...
But this is in Vientiane.
This is in Vientiane. And,
this is 1975.
1975.
Oh. Did you know a fellow named Paul Eyre?
No.
E-Y-R-E.
No. Was he Dong Do?
He was in Vientiane in 1974-75.
I didn't... I may have known him. Did he come with a wife?
I don't think so. He didn't mention that. I mean, he's married now. I didn't meet her, but I met him in Hawaii. And we
could have
we
been
talked.
I met him. I have... the name sort of rings a bell, and there were some, I remember some people coming late. One person in particular might have been Paul Ayer, had sort of a bad experience when his camera was stolen. And it just, he was staying in a village for orientation or something, and his camera was stolen. It just made me think how much things were just sort of disintegrating.
Yeah.
Because... earlier in the war, I just never would have worried about anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, just his name popped into my head when I was figuring out your chronology.
As I think about it, it's sort of... I didn't know him well.
No, obviously not. And it was sort of late. And he himself, when I was interviewing him, couldn't remember a lot of people that he knew. So I wouldn't, I'm not surprised that you couldn't remember him.
And also, in terms of a sense of success, I felt I was part of a success in the sense that the American Council stayed there.
In Vientiane?
Yeah.
Even after 75?
Right.
Okay.
And a businessman stayed, American businessman who had a big travel, rented agricultural equipment, done all sorts of things. He stayed. Part of a larger success in saying no to hate. Even when it meant there was a better way to lose a war than the way in Vietnam or than other wars, and it was just a better way to live. And so
but you only had, you said, 10 minutes to evacuate.
Yeah, we had 10 minutes to leave, and we had been planning to leave later in September. We left in March, May. Because April, I think, was the fall of Vietnam, and early May, May 5th or something, North Vietnamese tanks started coming into the capital. It was already a coalition government, so there were communist soldiers there already.
Right.
But my wife, by that time, had spent a year in the United States with my mother while I lived with her family. And she came back with U.S. citizenship. Because while she was in the United States, her father was captured, and we were told that she should probably get citizenship because if she didn't, if he were captured and the fact that we were married and so forth, she would need to get out, and people couldn't, Americans would not evacuate anyone except Americans.
So, well, your status would certainly jump up.
So she did get citizenship on very short notice. She had to say, the sun is shining, the sky is blue. She had to read that or something. And she had to say that the vice president would become president if the president died. And that seemed to give her a sufficient knowledge of English and American political science to become a citizen. And she had to wait 3 months.
Well, I was wondering, though, I repeated your words in a question about the 10 minutes to leave, because I was curious about that. Why were you given such a short time, and what do you think would have happened had you stayed?
Okay, the short time was that apparently we were told that tanks were coming in on the back roads, so it looked like a major occupation was happening, but sort of behind the scenes. I mean, they weren't coming down the main street. Or it was sort of a quiet but massive takeover. And my wife's passport was good before departure only by air. That was a restriction on her visa. So normally we would say, oh, we can leave any time by taking a boat across the Mekong.
Yeah.
But neither of us were swimmers, so that would give us sort of a little bit of apprehension. The Mekong is a big, fast river. And we were told this was the last flight out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that if we did not take this flight, they could not promise us that we would be able to leave by air. They also told us that all commercial flights were canceled, which was not true. If we had stayed, we probably could have gotten out on a later commercial flight. And we could have crossed the river clandestinely. I mean, we probably could have crossed the river even. I don't know. We might have been able to bribe somebody, just let her in a boat.
So it wasn't that you felt, either for yourself or for your wife, that there was some specific danger in a physical sense toward you, either of you?
No, we felt more a concern of being trapped,
okay.
Especially of her being trapped.
And not let go, even if she wasn't physically
not armed. Let out of the country.
That's
yeah.
right, yeah.
Because when she had requested her exit visa because we were leaving in the fall, she'd been given a little bit of a hard time at the Ministry of Interior.
Uh-huh.
And this was the Ministry of Interior. Well, it was coalition. But,
mm-hmm.
People were sort of hedging their bets at that point.
Okay.
And we had also, I forget why, but we had also, the embassy had said we could take out, for an emergency situation, Americans could, the embassy would give us $200 in cash, or would cash checks up to $200 or something
uh-huh,
like that.
Uh-huh.
And we had taken advantage of that, not realizing we would need the cash. So we left the cash with her family. $200 was a
uh-huh.
huge amount of money. And we left them with a house. Well, we didn't own the house, but the furniture and everything in it. But we did have to leave them. But we hadn't been planning to take them with us anyway.
Uh-huh.
But we had thought they might resettle in Thailand or something.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a problem in Laos. But we didn't have time to sort that out. We just left the money and say goodbye.
Skedaddled, yeah.
And they, our neighbors, turned out, had inventoried our house.
They knew what they wanted.
But my mother-in-law was having followed her husband as a soldier all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
She was could outfox anybody. One time, when they did come for the furniture, she hid it in a fish pond. She found out they were coming, hid it in the fish pond, which was, of course, very muddy in the city. It was rattan.
Uh-huh.
As soon as they left, she pulled it out and washed
it. Hosed it down. I asked you a little bit. I went back a second time on the timing thing, because again, that fellow that I mentioned, Paul Eyre, stayed for 2 months
after the
takeover.
But he probably left on his own. He probably left, and he may have even left on an airplane. But we were told no more commercial flights.
Well, it's
last evacuation flight, can't leave by river, and we said, trap. And he probably said, the heck with it.
Well, or he might not have been in town to hear it at the time or whatever. I was only wondering if his impression of the relatively peaceful takeover was a very different impression what you have,
in the sense that
it might have been violent,
yeah.
So you rushed out in 10 minutes, but you were only really concerned about bringing your wife out as expeditiously as possible.
Right.
And it didn't have any fear of bloodbaths and things like that.
No. The Lao were... I mean, even when the students at Don Doak and other places were demonstrating at the USAID camp, There was never a concern about violence.
Okay. I was only thought that that might have been part of it, and I wanted to draw you out before telling you what I was searching for.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
To see if there was a discrepancy between the two eyewitnesses, but you're very similar.
Right. Okay. And there were people that were unaccounted for the day I left, including one person who was paraplegic.
Oh, uh-huh.
And had a loud wife. So. But the council had stayed there.
Yeah.
And assumed responsibility for these, for at least telling these people what the situation was. And everybody, of course, had a choice. And
he stayed too.
The French, well, the French stay forever.
I mean, the French is never.
There was a Frenchman who lived across the street from us, married to a woman. He wouldn't even think of leaving.
Yeah. Yeah. let me look over the some of the questions that I had, because I think you covered some of them. I was wondering about your living with the Lau family, and you answered that, and you mentioned the University of Hawaii thing and the Lau High School in Vietnam, which I thought was incredibly impressive, and your mitigating role. The Chinese engineers.
Oh, another thing about the mitigating role was just the reconciliation of her family afterwards. How, after they left Laos, I mean, they left Laos when we left, about the time we left Iran. And we were here, and then they came, and just the sense of, they had been poor there, they had been sort of marginalized in the village.
Yeah.
And everything just sort of came together here. They did well. They helped a lot of other Laotians. And the mother came, and eventually the father came, and they were reunited. I mean, there just seemed to be a lot of reconciliation there that was nice. And
healthy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lao, they help each other a lot. You know, they have a ceremony called the Basi, and big events happen, good or bad, in somebody's life. Everyone will gather.
You call it Basi.
Yeah, it's a ceremony where there's a flower arrangement, and you call the spirits. You summon the spirits that have scattered from your body, and you call them back into everybody's body, and you loosely tie strings around the wrist to hold the spirits in.
Uh-huh.
And everybody feels they've got it together again.
Okay. That isn't the same thing as what I've heard people describe as a bon, or bon?
Bon is a festival, so it's more of a public, like it might be Buddhist Lent or...
That's what I was given, but to understand, and this is somewhat different.
This is like a house ceremony.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, my sister-in-law's husband's father came out of open heart surgery. 5 days he came out of the hospital and went home. And he was ready to give up. And they had a Basi ceremony for him. And he just picked him up. 100 people came, and they just, you know, they gather they don't make it. It's not like born-again Christians, all sort of gathering like bees on him or something.
Yeah, like laying
they're
hands there,
and such, and they may be drinking and joking and laughing, but they're also, there is this spiritual aspect of calling the spirits back, and people come up to him and tie a string on his wrist and wish him quick recovery and long life and riches and all these things that they bless people with. And it seems to have a real strengthening effect. But, you know, our religion mostly gets out of the house.
And,
it's so institution-oriented.
And ritualistic.
Yeah, and you don't often get 50 or 100 people in your house just to bless you.
No, I've never had that happen, because I've never been, you know, knock on wood, that thick. or that not like my head is, but you know, that's sick. I'm sorry, not the.
Yeah, but it could be just traveling someplace or welcoming you back from having gone on your research. Or,
so there's all sorts of possibilities.
Yeah. Okay. Marriage and.
A couple of questions. What were your impressions if you compared the Royal Laotian Army and the Pathet Lao in terms of the ideology and discipline, strength and focusedness, and etc.?
Well, the Royal Lao Army that I saw was the village garrison. A
Which
lot
is
of them
not
were
necessarily
farm boys.
The regular.
And, well, they weren't necessarily the elite troops.
Right.
And, like, one boy, shortly after I got there, was on an assignment. He planted a mine and turned around and stepped on it. And he'd just been married. He was a country boy. And they and when you had to build a school or something, they could easily supply four or five people who would be glad to help the carpenter out and things like that. But when after the village was attacked, and they needed to make sure the attackers had left the area, they brought in some paratroopers to sort of beef up the local garrison, and they marched off.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Royal Lao Army is local garrison troops is that's sort of my impression of them. But now in the capital, there was the right wing aspect of the army that I perhaps read more about than actually knew myself.
Uh-huh.
But they were people who had connections with generals in Thailand and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones that were being pushed by the CIA and sort of opposed by the State Department. My impression was the State Department sort of supported Savonarola.
Mm-hmm.
And the CIA wanted to see a right-wing military dictator. They were supporting Pumi Nosavan, who was an ex-gym teacher and a relative of General Supersit or somebody in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they played their hand and didn't work. And, and typically Laotian, the good guys won, in the sense that the moderates won. Although, in the end, in Laos, the extreme elements of the communists did take power. Suphanuvong was a front person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the radicals eventually did take power, but these people I thought of as the hardline, sort of the Vietnamese-style communists, as opposed to the French-style communists, which I would call it Suphanuvong, sort of a French style.
Okay. That's an interesting.
He would, when he was imprisoned
contrast.
At one point, he read Greek and Latin
mm-hmm.
in his prison cell, which I can't think of the names of some of the others, but when the hardliners wouldn't have, they might have known some Chinese, they might have been able to read the sayings of Mao Zedong or something, but it just, different. Whole different worldview.
Yeah, no, it really sounded like it. And did you get to really see or know any Pathet Lao?
No, personally, I mean, Fred Brampton used to go into the Russian embassy and try to strike up a conversation, and he knew Russians who said that, oh yeah, we know you guys are doing a good job and so forth. Too bad you can't talk to Fred. Have you been able to track him down?
Yeah. My partner is talking to him, because Fred lives in California.
Oh.
And Mark is there now.
Oh, yeah.
Before I left Statesboro, I talked to Mark, who had gone on his thing before, started before I did.
Yeah.
And he had, last time I heard, he had already made an appointment date with Fred.
Okay.
But that's like 10 days ago now, so I haven't heard.
Yeah.
You know. So I assume they got together and had a little chat. Did you ever get to know, speaking of other personalities, did you ever get to know or meet the famous or infamous, depending on the perspective, the Pop Yule who was up in the mountains
Now, I never met him personally. Uh-huh. I mean, I had heard of him.
Right.
I'd heard stories of him. I guess he was some... I had heard that he was somebody who'd lost his family.
His wife died.
Yeah, and so he decided to just sort of start again. He was... I think he was a very sincere person.
Mm-hmm.
And he really wanted to give something to the people he was working with. My understanding was he sort of helped... he was sort of acting on his own in many ways before the CIA and others mm-hmm. got involved. He was organizing the Hmong to...
I'm not really sure of all of the...
Yeah, what's where truth and myth.
Yeah, where truth and myth and where chronology is correct
but,
or skewed. Yeah,
I've always wondered how much of history, where you say a government declared war or something like that, a government is just... realize that something private citizens have started or have gotten going,
mm-hmm.
they're just putting sort of their stamp on it to try to give the illusion that they were in charge and they did it. Like Pavie, the French, he was in Laos, and I don't know whether he was a postal worker or what he was, but his influence was enormous, out of all proportion to his rank or his position. Just his sheer personality. I think he helped basically draw the borders of Laos. And enormous energy, enormous interest. I don't think Pop Rio was a Pavie, but he was, I think he was sort of, he was a factor in himself, especially
yeah.
early in the war.
Later on, I think no individual could have been a factor of themselves. It became a machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. On both sides.
Yeah. But I knew a missionary. There was Don Scott, who later headed up World. It's a relief organization. Maybe it's even World Relief. I forget. But it's a Christian relief organization. He was a Christian Missionary Alliance missionary.
Mm-hmm.
He was a tall Canadian. He used to tell, he was in the Canadian Navy, and he used to tell stories about how when they went on leave in Hawaii, none of the Canadian sailors would want to go with him because he carried a Bible. And all the people they wanted to associate would see this guy with a Bible and just head in the other direction. But he was a missionary there, and he used to go into... deep into communist territory, and he would stand out like a sore thumb, and villagers would, say, send us a missionary, and he'd go, and he'd
uh-huh.
go into these villages, and they'd want to send out offerings, missionaries and a lot of people they were all considered CIA, or all considered
uh-huh.
American Tahan soldiers,
uh-huh.
because it was all, in the eyes of the Lao, it was all just sort of one group. I mean, Americans were Americans.
Uh-huh.
And I was in Luang Prabang briefly at a school there. I was teaching in Vientiane, and the teacher up there got sick. And my wife and I went up for a semester or something.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And we taught there. And... this is the royal capital now, and every morning there would be a meeting of all the Americans
uh-huh.
at the AID office, and all the Americans were about seven of us,
uh-huh.
included military attaches, CIA, English teachers at the local school, aid officials, engineers, and we'd just chat.
Uh-huh.
Go around the room. You have anything to say? For example, one session I said, well, my neighbor's son just came home. He was a soldier. He came back. He was said he was out of position, and he had it had been overrun. He had had to flee for several days. He was sort of torn out and so forth from brambles and stuff like that. He had come to the city and as a soldier to the camp and was told there was no medicine. He would have to go to the Chinese pharmacy and buy his own medicine. And the the military attaché said,
"What?
We just finished giving them a huge..." And they realized that the Lao military was selling mm-hmm. medicine they were giving for their own troops to the Chinese.
Would then sell it to the soldiers who should have got it for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the royal capital was so small. Mm-hmm. There were just a handful of Americans there. But the way that the State Department under aid on this, there were, under Walter, was it William Sullivan?
Mm-hmm.
Was the ambassador. And under Kennedy, there was a very nice, I thought, a nice sense of civilians being in control and everybody sort of working together.
Mm-hmm.
When Godfrey came under Nixon, mm-hmm. just everything changed. Communication broke. It was the military making decisions. It was just sort of an impression I had. Like that meeting in Long Run, I don't think that ever would have occurred under when Godfrey was in the ambassador. Everybody would be off in their own little world.
Yeah.
One of our neighbors here is married to a niece of Godfrey's or something. But, and the Lao saw it that way too. Everybody's working together.
So that, yeah. Even if you didn't wear the uniform, you still sat in the same room and chatted every Monday morning.
Yeah.
So you were on some level at the same playing field.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to use your bathroom.
Okay.
And I'll pause this for a moment. And I'm putting this back on again because I wanted to thank you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Thank you for being interested in IVS.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a group of people that are incredibly interesting. Yeah, it really is. And from one person to another in different perspectives and times. When I was in the facilities just a few seconds ago, I was thinking that it's too bad that for logistical reasons our visit is very short.
Or that we couldn't all get together.
That I wouldn't have wanted because I learned when I was early in Hawaii, make the individuals as individuals because they all have their unique stories. Because even, and maybe especially, but even spouses, one will drown out the other.
Mm-hmm.
So one always seems to dominate, whether it's male or female.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is not my first time to Boston. It's my third. There's always the possibility of a conference, and I hope that I can give you a call or something like that, even if it's not related to this project, and just say hi.
Well, thank you. I hope also, did you say something in one of the pieces of that came out about access to the results of the study?
Yeah. Do you want a copy of the final research summary?
Mm-hmm.
And a notice of any publications that result.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, and now I think I'll turn this off. Unless there was anything that I forgot to ask you or you weren't able to add that you think might be especially relevant?
There was nothing sort of hanging in my mind
that
I wanted to say.
All right. So then I'll not only pause this, but actually turn it off. Goodbye.